Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. Funny thing about being fast, you end up waiting a lot. First to show up, first in line, then just waiting. Me, I rev up Chumba Casino. With over 200 social casino games, no slow lanes here. Why sit around when you can spin? I'm already racing. Your turn. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. That's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
On the night of September 1st, 2002, 35-year-old Michael Tardio and 31-year-old Christopher Monson drove to a restaurant on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles, preparing to finalize a deal that could change their lives. They were meeting with the man only known as Mr. Big to sell $1 million worth of jewelry which had once belonged to Michael's girlfriend, Playboy bunny Sandy Bentley. Hours later, a Mercedes SUV was found engulfed in flames in an upscale Studio City neighborhood. Inside, Michael and Chris were both dead, each shot multiple times in the chest. The jewelry was gone, and the fire erased all forensic evidence. Despite years of investigation, the case remains unsolved, leaving investigators asking, who was Mr. Big, and what really happened the night Michael and Chris were killed? Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. So we're back for another week. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. And before we get into this week's case, I just want to let you know that next week I will be off. I'm currently, as you're watching this episode, in Los Angeles, filming the reunion for Traitors, and then I'm taking the family on a cruise in the Bahamas. It's been a long time since I've gone on a little vacay, so I'm looking forward to that. So I'm taking a week off from Detective Perspective, but if you're Crime Weekly listeners or viewers, there will be an episode out there, and the series that we're covering is extremely fascinating. So if you're not already a subscriber, head over there, watch that episode. It's a great one. So as far as this week's case is concerned, we've all heard that saying, this is a story right out of Hollywood. Well, this is literally a story out of Hollywood, and it's a real story. It actually happened. Somebody didn't write this up and just make it for your enjoyment. There are two people that are dead, and the story behind what led to their deaths is extremely fascinating. These are two individuals, Michael Tardio and Christopher Monson, who definitely got involved with the wrong people. These were not career criminals, and they made some missteps, and they made some choices that ultimately resulted in them being killed. Now, I'll come right on to tell you that Michael Tardio is the main driver in this story. Christopher Monson appears to be just someone who was at the wrong place at the wrong time. I think he had a feeling that this might not be the right move, but he was trying to be a good friend. But I definitely want to talk about the story. I want to talk about how we got here, and we're going to discuss some of the theories because as we sit here today, as multiple law enforcement officials have said, the murderer is still out there. And there probably is multiple people involved walking around responsible for what happened to Michael and Chris. So we want to do our best to bring this story to the masses and make sure that if there's any possible way these offenders can be held accountable and brought to justice, we want to do that. So let's not waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. Christopher Stewart Monson was born on August 23rd, 1971, to parents Chris Sr. and Irene. He grew up in Tucson, Arizona, in a well-off family where his father worked as a business executive. In 1995, after earning a bachelor's degree in political science and communications, Chris moved to Los Angeles, hoping to make it as an actor. While in LA, Chris took acting classes and managed a self-storage business that he and his father started. Outside of work, he had a passion for racing, cars, motorcycles, anything that gave him that adrenaline rush. He also loved the water, spending his free time swimming, water skiing, and surfing. Chris had a reputation for being kind and charismatic, someone with an infectious smile and a great sense of humor. His father said that he, quote, loved life. Within a few years of moving to LA, Chris met Michael Tardio, and the two quickly became best friends. Michael was born on November 17, 1966, to parents Neil and Margaret. He also came from a successful background. His family owned Neil Tardio Productions, a commercial production company in New York City that worked with celebrities and athletes. And for a time, Michael worked for his father. Michael was known for his sharp wit and sense of humor, and his family and friends meant everything to him. He was married to a woman named Kelsey, and they had two children, Lucas and Riley. And by all accounts, he was a devoted father who adored his kids. In 1998, Michael decided to move to Los Angeles to pursue a career in the entertainment industry. While there, he worked as a model and took a job as a bouncer at the Garden of Eden nightclub. His boss later told the Los Angeles Times, quote, he was a very stand-up guy. Like Chris, Michael loved a good adrenaline rush, so the two spent a lot of time together racing motorcycles. By 2001, Michael was dating a woman he had met at the nightclub, Sandy Bentley, and Sandy had a complicated history. She and her twin sister, Mandy, had been Playboy bunnies and even appeared on the May 2000 cover of Playboy together. Now, both sisters had also dated Hugh Hefner, you may have heard of that name before, and they lived in the Playboy mansion for a period of time. Now, some of you are probably saying, hey, Derek, didn't you just mention that Michael was married to Kelsey? Yeah, you're right, I did. And to be completely transparent, we don't know exactly what's going on here. When we were doing the research, there wasn't much mention of Kelsey or the kids, but as we dug deeper, we saw that on his headstone, it said beloved husband, and then we found Kelsey. Now, what the relationship was, what was going on there, we truly don't know. And frankly, for this story, I don't think it's very relevant, but I'm always going to be transparent with you guys and try to give you all the facts. So that's what we know. As far as the specifics, it's unclear. But Michael wasn't the only one with complicated relationships, because while Sandy was involved with Hefner, she was also dating a wealthy Wall Street trader named Mark Yagala. Now, if you're going to believe the Los Angeles Times, Mark was obsessed with Sandy. In just over a year, he spent $6 million on her, showering her with gifts including a $1.7 million mansion in Las Vegas, luxury cars, furs, and high-end jewelry. Among those pieces he gifted her was a $500,000 diamond ring and a ruby and diamond platinum necklace reportedly worth $250,000. Now, interesting little side note here, the necklace was similar to the one that Richard Gere gave Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman, which happened to be Sandy's favorite movie. But there was one little problem with all of this. The money Mark was spending? Yeah, it wasn't his. Mark had been running a massive Ponzi scheme, stealing over $50 million from 110 investors. And by the fall of 2000, his scheme had collapsed, he was arrested, and he would later be sentenced to prison. Since Mark had used stolen money to buy Sandy's gifts, a federal court ordered her to return everything, the mansion, the jewelry, the cars, the furs, you name it, it had to go back. But Sandy refused. She even threatened to sue to keep whatever money they made from selling Mark's gifts. And I just want to point out here that while all of this is going on, Sandy had already moved on from Mark Yagala and was now dating Michael Tardio. So investigators believe that after the court ordered Sandy to hand over everything Mark had given her, she panicked. She was about to lose her home, her cars, and all the expensive jewelry that she had accumulated. She told Michael everything was about to be taken away, and she was afraid she'd be homeless. According to CBS, she later claimed that Michael suggested she keep a few pieces and sell them for some quick cash, but investigators have never been able to confirm whether that was really Michael's idea, as he's not around to defend himself. But regardless of who came up with the plan, it is confirmed that Michael and Sandy broke into what used to be her Las Vegas mansion and stole nearly $1 million in jewelry and furs. Investigators were able to determine exactly how much was taken because a court-appointed receiver was outside and saw them break in. After Sandy and Michael left, the receiver went inside and assessed the damage. That pretty woman necklace that I mentioned earlier that was worth hundreds of thousands of dollars? Yeah, that was gone. So was the $500,000 ring, along with watches, earrings, bracelets, and more. When confronted about the missing items, Sandy insisted that they had either gone missing or had been taken by someone else. At some point after the break-in, Michael and Sandy started looking for a buyer for the stolen jewelry. According to investigators, Michael told people at the Garden of Eden nightclub that he was willing to sell everything for $1 million in cash. Now, Michael's decision to tell people at the club that he was currently in possession of $1 million in jewelry was obviously not a good one. When you think about clubs, they can be fun, but there can also be patrons that frequent those types of establishments who may either be bad people or know bad people. So when word gets around and Michael's not aware of who now knows what he has, that's where you create the problem. And we're gonna talk much more about that in the perspective. So even though Michael was offering this amazing deal, no one took him up on it at the club. And that's when he turned to Linda Kim, an international weapons broker. So if he didn't cross any unsavory characters at the club, he decided to step it up to an international weapons broker. Probably not the best decision. Now, surprisingly, Linda later told CBS that Michael met her at a hotel she owned in LA to pitch her what he described as a, quote, deal of a lifetime. He offered to sell her all the jewelry for $1 million, but Linda was immediately suspicious. She described the jewelry as very special and very high quality, but something about the deal felt off, so she turned him down. Michael and Sandy kept looking for a buyer, and by August of 2002, Michael Jacobs, a convicted felon who had met Michael Tardio at the club, told him he had found someone willing to make the deal. The buyer was known only as Mr. Big, and he was willing to pay the full $1 million for the jewelry. But as we will learn, there may have been some ulterior motives at play here. Let's take our break. We'll be right back.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
All right, we're back. And before break, I had just mentioned that Mr. Big had agreed to this $1 million deal per Michael Jacobs, the convicted felon. And as you would expect, Michael agreed to meet Mr. Big on September 1st. And to prepare, he rented a Mercedes SUV. And before heading to the meeting, he asked a Hollywood stuntman to come with him and serve as a backup, but the stuntman refused. He had a bad feeling about the whole deal and he didn't want to go. Good call. So Michael then turned to his best friend, Chris Monson, and according to detectives who later spoke to the Los Angeles Times, Chris was also hesitant. He had, quote, misgivings about the entire plan, but he was a loyal friend, and in the end, he agreed to go. And obviously, that would be a fatal mistake. So September 1st comes, and Michael had the night off from the club, so just hours before he was supposed to meet up for the deal with Mr. Big, he made one last attempt to sell the jewelry to Linda Kim. And in that same interview with CBS, Linda told them that Michael seemed really desperate. She got the sense that he really needed to get rid of the jewelry soon, but she refused to take it. She told him directly that she felt uncomfortable with the whole situation and that the jewelry had a really bad energy, so once again, she declined the offer. So at around 9:30 p.m., Michael picked up Chris, and the two drove to a restaurant on Sunset Boulevard where investigators believed they were supposed to meet Mr. Big. What was discussed during that meeting remains unknown, but at some point it's believed that the three of them left and headed into the Hollywood Hills. From there, only the killer or killers know the rest of the story. And I do want to mention before I get to the perspective, because I'm not going to address it, I thought about it as well. Were there any cameras in the area, in the restaurant or outside the restaurant? As far as I can tell, there were not, because otherwise we would have the identity of Mr. Big and his associates if there were other people there. But from what we can see, there's been no mention of any surveillance footage, so I have to imagine it doesn't exist. So at around 1:30 a.m. on what was now September 2nd, a motorist spotted a Mercedes SUV engulfed in flames in the 11,600 block of Woodridge Street in Studio City, a neighborhood that borders the Hollywood Hills. When firefighters arrived and put out the fire, they made a gruesome discovery. Inside the vehicle, in the front seats, were two bodies, 35-year-old Michael Tardio and 31-year-old Chris Monson. Now, both had been shot multiple times in the chest, and it's important to note that there were no bullet holes outside the vehicle. So why do I make that notation? It doesn't look like this was a drive-by where Chris and Michael were sitting in the car and someone pulled up and just shot into the vehicle. It's more likely that they were shot and then placed inside the vehicle after the fact. I will say this, I don't have crime scene photos. I would like to know the entry and exit wounds, if there were any exit wounds. Was there damage to the seats that they were sitting in to suggest that someone could have been in the vehicle with them at the time they were shot? Unfortunately, that information has not been released publicly. But I will say, just based on what we know, it's more than likely that Chris and Michael were outside the vehicle, met up with someone or a group of people, were killed, and then placed back inside the vehicle before it was set on fire. Now, the area where the SUV was found was considered an upscale neighborhood, not the kind of place where violent crime typically occurred. One detective later told CBS, quote, "It's not the kind of place where you're going to find two people murdered on the street." Investigators canvassed the area, speaking with residents, but no one had heard the gunshots. This led them to believe that the men had been shot elsewhere before their bodies were placed inside the SUV, driven to Studio City, and set on fire. And this is exactly what I was just saying. So now you have no bullet hole entries into the vehicle, and also no residents from that surrounding community hearing the gunshots, which aligns more with the fact that they were in fact killed somewhere else and then placed inside that vehicle. Now, the idea that you would be driving around with these two individuals, deceased individuals, and then park that vehicle, place them in the front seats, leave them there, set it on fire, seems like a stretch, but it's not impossible. I don't know the exact area where they were found, and it's likely that the perpetrator or perpetrators was able to drive to that location without being seen, do exactly what I just said, and got out of there before anybody noticed. And depending on how many people were involved, this would be a relatively quick process, which is why I tend to believe that there was more than one party on the offender side of things. Hoping to find out more information, investigators went to the Garden of Eden nightclub, where Michael's co-workers told them about the stolen jewelry and his attempts to sell it. Now, investigators did search the SUV hoping to find the jewelry, but it was already gone. So based on everything investigators gathered about Michael and the missing jewelry, they now believe that Michael and Chris had been robbed and killed. Then at that point, the SUV was torched to destroy any evidence, and the plan had worked. There was no usable fingerprints and no physical evidence left behind. So as far as the offenders were concerned, this was a success. When the news about Chris and Michael's murders became public, many people were shocked to learn that they had been caught up in anything this dangerous. Michael's brother Neil later said that he believed Michael was, quote, in over his head. And I completely agree. I said it at the top of the show. I may say it again. Michael was not a career criminal. He's probably only watched a few movies that had these types of things going on in it. And when you start spreading this type of information about what you're in possession of, whether it's money, jewelry, drugs, the wrong people can find out about it. And I will tell you, as a law enforcement officer in my career, there were some home invasions and robberies that I had to investigate and later learned that the people who robbed the victims, the quote unquote victims, they didn't even know them. They had just heard about what these victims were in possession of And a lot of times it was drug dealers who were the victims, where they're holding a lot of drugs or money, and a rival gang will hear about it and they'll just break into the house and take it. So if the wrong person finds out about what you have, it could end really bad for you. And I think Michael's inexperience really played a factor here, because if he had known that, I don't think he would have been as vocal about what he currently had. Hoping to learn more information, investigators brought Sandy Bentley in for questioning. And as you would imagine, she denied that Michael and Chris had been trying to sell the jewelry, but detectives were not convinced. One of the investigators later told CBS, quote, "Sandy wasn't real cooperative. Sandy was out to protect herself." But they didn't have enough evidence to arrest her, so they had to let her go. Months later, investigators brought Sandy back in for more questioning, and this time they warned her that she could face jail time if she wasn't honest. So this time, she cooperated, striking a deal to avoid prosecution for the thefts that occurred at the mansion. After striking the deal, she admitted that she and Michael had planned to sell the jewelry and said Michael had finally found a buyer through someone at the Garden of Eden nightclub. According to Sandy, Michael had been talking to a guy at the nightclub who claimed a wealthy buyer, known only as Mr. Big, was willing to purchase the items. Now, she didn't know much about Mr. Big, only that he had a lot of money and drove expensive cars. Sandy said Michael asked to set up a meeting with Mr. Big, and plans were made for Labor Day weekend. Now, as I mentioned earlier, in preparation, Michael rented the Mercedes SUV and also began looking for a cash counting machine to verify the $1 million in cash he expected to receive. Investigators later told CBS that this detail showed how little street knowledge Michael actually had. No experienced dealer would sit in a car feeding stacks of cash through a machine to make sure it was all there, and no serious buyer would wait around for that to happen. And I have to agree, this is what I've said multiple times. Michael may have had an idea of how it was supposed to go down based on TV and movies, but that's not how it happens in the real world. No one's going to sit around in a car with a cash counting machine waiting for you to verify the money. Now, I will say this in Michael's defense. If there was more information to the story than we know, than investigators know, maybe Michael knew that the deal was going to start at this restaurant and then end at someone's residence, where they would be in the safety of the home and they would have the time to go through the jewelry and count the cash. If that's the case, then I can understand where Michael thought, okay, I'm going to bring this with me to make sure before I leave that the money's all there. Obviously, the suspect or suspects had other plans, but if that's the case, I could see why Michael may have thought he would have had the opportunity to count the money. Either way, it doesn't change the fact that Michael was very inexperienced and he probably got into a situation that he was not equipped to handle. Now, before leaving to meet Mr. Big, Michael gave Sandy a phone number and told her, quote, "If anything happens, call this number." Sandy said the last time she spoke to Michael was around 11:30 p.m. on September 1st, when he told her they were driving through the Mount Olympus area. After that, all calls went unanswered, so she called the number Michael had given her. It's unclear what was said during that conversation, but what we do know is that when investigators traced the number, they discovered it belonged to Michael Jacobs, the convicted felon who had introduced Michael Tardio to Mr. Big. So as you would expect, investigators brought Jacobs in for questioning multiple times, but he refused to talk. The only thing he would confirm was that Sandy did in fact call him on the night of September 1st looking for Michael. As investigators dug deeper, they discovered that Michael and Jacobs had spoken multiple times throughout the day and into the night of the murders. Cell phone records placed Jacobs in the area where Michael and Chris met Mr. Big, and later those same records showed activity in the area where the bodies were found in the burning SUV. Not looking good for Michael Jacobs. Investigators continued to put pressure on Jacobs and kept him under surveillance, believing he was the key to the case. But without enough evidence to charge him, they had no way to move forward. And this is the unfortunate reality of a homicide investigation. It's not what you know, it's what you can prove in a court of law. Is there information to suggest that Michael Jacobs set up the deal? Yes. Do his cell phone records make him look bad by showing him in the area of the initial interaction and then where the bodies were found? Of course. But is that enough to convince a jury? I don't think so. You need more than that. If he is not willing to cooperate and he's not saying much, you can't really corroborate his story. I don't know exactly what was said, but clearly it wasn't enough to discredit what he was saying, and I think that leaves some holes. There's a real possibility that Michael set up the deal, but if Mr. Big is a real person, he could still be out there. So let's say they take this shot at Michael Jacobs and they miss, And then they later find out that there is, in fact, a Mr. Big, and he may be responsible for the murders. You can charge him, but good luck getting him convicted, because I can promise you his defense team is going to bring up the fact that you were convinced it was Michael Jacobs, and now you're saying it's their client. It can create a lot of issues. So I think detectives feel like Michael's involved, Michael Jacobs, that is, but they don't have enough to put the murders on him directly. And that's a big issue. By mid-December of 2003, detectives investigating the murders of Michael and Chris were desperate for new leads. And in an effort to generate tips, the LAPD announced a $25,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of any suspects. At that time, investigators stated that Sandy and Mark, you know, the guy who originally bought her the jewelry, were not considered suspects. They also believed that the stolen jewelry was long gone, likely broken down, melted, and sold off in pieces. Now, although this could be the case, I don't know if it's necessarily true. In smaller cases with jewelry that's not as valuable, yes, it's sold and then melted down so it can't be traced. But with something this unique, two pieces that are this unique, it's also possible, based on the black market, that somewhere in this country or another country, those pieces are sitting in someone's safe. We may never see it, but they could still be intact. Investigators also told the Los Angeles Times that they were fairly certain that Michael and Chris had been killed by the person or people they had been meeting to sell the jewelry. However, they also explored other theories just in case. One possible scenario they explored was the fact that the suspect had prior dealings with Michael or Chris, leading to the deadly confrontation. And I didn't completely follow this one, but I think what they're trying to say is, okay, maybe Michael or Chris had an enemy out there that they were unaware of, or maybe they were aware of, and this person pretended that they had the money to buy the jewelry just to set them up, get them alone, and kill them. Michael and Chris were not hiding from anyone. Michael worked at a public place, a club, where you could walk in there and you can get him if you really want to. So I don't know if someone would go through all of this trouble just to kill them. And from what we do know, investigators didn't find anything in Michael or Chris's past that would suggest they had dealings with individuals who would do something like this. As I've mentioned multiple times, Michael and Chris, they were in way over their heads. So I don't think this scenario is very likely, and I don't think investigators think it's very likely. Another theory that was looked into was that Michael had been targeted by one of the many clubgoers he had turned away while working at the Garden of Eden. Now, this is just another one where, just like the first one, I don't think it's very likely. Can you imagine someone who was pissed off enough because they couldn't get into a club to set up this elaborate plan just to kill Michael? It doesn't make a lot of sense, and there's a lot of risk in it. You got to think about this whole situation, going to a first location, then a secondary location, the money, the security cameras, everything that could be tied back to this particular person who carried out these crimes. Are you going to go through all that just because Michael didn't allow you into a club one night? I don't see it. Where I do think there is some smoke and potentially a fire is that while Michael is talking about this jewelry at the club, someone who he was not targeting overhears the conversation, gets involved, maybe goes to Michael Jacobs, and now they know they don't have the money, but they don't care. All they want is for Michael to bring the jewelry to them so they can rob him and kill him. And ultimately, that is what investigators believe as well. At the end of the day, they think that the motive is robbery, and I completely agree.
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Despite the reward, no significant leads came in, and the case remained unsolved. In 2011, nearly a decade after the murders, the Los Angeles City Council increased the reward to $75,000. During the announcement, City Councilman Paul Kerkorian addressed the ongoing mystery, saying, quote, "However interesting it may be, however salacious the details may be, this is a tragic murder. Someplace, there is a murderer who is still at large." He went on to emphasize the importance of solving the case, stating, quote, "Some people may think it's not as important as a murder that happened a month ago, but the truth is, for 9 years, there has been a murderer on the loose. It's clear that there's someone who committed a multiple murder that's still at large, and we can't accept that." Unfortunately, that is the last update I have in this case. The murders of Michael Tardio and Christopher Monson have gone largely unreported, but their loved ones are still searching for answers, hoping that one day, the killer or killers will be held accountable. Okay, let's dive into this perspective because I want to recap some things, elaborate on some of the information I already relayed to you, and then talk about potential theories. So first off, as I said at the top of the show, Michael made a lot of mistakes. The biggest one being how many people he told about the jewelry, specifically the Garden of Eden, all the patrons at that club, the people that worked there, any one of them, even if they didn't have an axe to grind with him, could have said, you know what? I don't have that money, but I want that jewelry. And so we could be looking at a suspect who has no previous connection to Michael or Chris whatsoever. Then you have Linda Kim, weapons dealer. Who's she involved in? She might have said on the surface, yeah, I don't want the jewelry. It's too suspicious for me. It doesn't feel right. And yet she could have told some of her colleagues or individuals that she worked with, hey, listen, I don't want nothing to do with this, but this person over here is holding on to a lot of jewelry and you may want to grab that. Which brings me to something else. There's no honor amongst thieves. And so when you have a bunch of criminals in an area and they find out that another criminal is holding on to some stolen jewelry, they're not going to care about taking it because they know if they take that jewelry, what is the person going to go do? Report the jewelry to the police? Hey, I stole $1 million worth of jewelry and somebody stole it from me? No. So whoever ends up with it, fair game. And I've seen this in other situations, one being sex work, where you have a John who goes out there and proceeds to engage in an interaction, right? A transactional situation where they agree on a certain amount of money in exchange for a sexual act. And when it's time to perform the sexual act after the person is already paid, they take off. They take the money and they run without doing anything. And in many instances, the Johns will just say, you know what? That's the game you play. I guess I got to go home. I can't really report this to the police. In other instances, the Johns do come forward and say, hey, this person just took money from me. You know, this is what was supposed to go down. They'll usually tell a different version, but you know what they're talking about. And so it's the same thing here where Michael and Christopher, amongst the other criminals, are looked at as a criminal. And so they're saying, hey, listen, survival of the fittest out here. If we can get to that jewelry, we're going to take it. And I really think that's what happened here. I think that Michael and Christopher were playing in an arena that they had no business playing in. Which brings us to some of the different scenarios here, one of them being the most likely, but we'll address the others quickly. And I didn't even mention some of these in the episode because they weren't mentioned by law enforcement. One of them being a random act of violence, a carjacking, if you will. Could it be just the worst luck ever where Michael and Christopher are driving in this expensive car, this Mercedes, and they get carjacked by someone who doesn't know what's inside that vehicle at the time, but once they figure out what it is, they decide, oh, I can't leave these two alive. So they shoot both of them at a different location, drive the car to a spot, set it on fire, take the jewelry, and they're out of there. Is it possible? Of course, it's definitely possible. I don't think it's likely. The next theory I want to discuss again quickly is that someone at the club found out about the deal that was going down with Mr. Big and intercepted them before getting to the final destination. What do I mean by that? Someone's in there who doesn't have the money, but hears from Michael Jacobs or someone else that there's going to be a deal going down. They're going to be in the specific car. They're going to this location. If you get to them before they get there, you can get the jewelry. They may have had no connection to the deal itself, but because they knew where, when, and how, they were able to get to Michael and Christopher before they got there. They grab the jewelry, they kill him, they bring the car somewhere, set it on fire, and they're gone, and nobody even knows who they are, maybe just a few people at the club. The final scenario that I want to discuss at length is the one that I believe is most likely, and that's that the entire thing was a setup. And if you're looking at it from that perspective, through that lens, you have to look at Michael Jacobs because of what his involvement was in the initial setup of the deal in conjunction with the cell phone records putting him at both locations during the time of the incidents in question. So when we look at Michael Jacobs, we think about Mr. Big. Is he an actual person or was this someone who was made up? Was there ever $1 million actually in play here, or was this just to get Michael and Christopher out in a vulnerable location where they wouldn't be able to defend themselves? Both scenarios are at play, but when we look at what happened and you look at who could be involved, you have to think about a few specific things. And to me, one of the most specific things that I can think of is the Mercedes SUV. How many people would know that Michael was going to be driving that specific car on that specific day in that specific location? Not many. We know that Michael Jacobs was talking to him throughout the day, so he's one suspect. But this was not Michael's car, so he rented it. Nobody knew what he was going to get for a rental, so it would only be people who had direct contact with Michael leading up to that day. And one of those people that we know for sure would be Michael Jacobs. Were there others? Are there others on that call record that could have also known that Michael and Christopher were going to be in the Mercedes? Maybe. Only law enforcement has access to those call records. But that's where you kind of minimize this pool of people to pull from, because Michael didn't get that car until that day. So the amount of people who would have known about it, it's very small. And so when we dive into the actual robbery, right, there's a couple ways this could have went down. First off, they show up with the jewelry, there's no money, they're robbed at gunpoint, they're killed, they're put into the car is disposed of somewhere else. The second one is that they show up with Mr. Big, they give him the jewelry, Mr. Big gives them the money, they start to leave, and then they're intercepted by someone else, maybe connected to Mr. Big, maybe connected to Michael Jacobs, maybe connected to someone else. But now that Michael and Christopher are in possession of the money, that's when the second group or the singular person go after them. And why? Why would they wait? Well, if Mr. Big is as bad as people have made him out to be, maybe the second party doesn't want to rob him because they know the repercussions if they do so. But who cares about Christopher and Michael? They're nobodies, right? They're not these big criminals that you have to worry about as far as retaliation. If someone takes them out, who's going to really come after them? So they wait for the exchange. Mr. Big leaves. And then once he does, that's when these guys move in. They say, hey, give us the money. They drive them somewhere. Christopher and Michael agree. They think they're just going to be let go. Unfortunately, that's not the case. They can't let them go now because they've seen their faces. They kill him, dump the vehicle. And the answer to how this all went down relies on another question, which is how many people were involved? Was it one person? Was it two people? Was it a organized group? If you figure out that answer, then you can reverse engineer the crime and figure out who's at the root of it. And I know if law enforcement was sitting here right now, they'd probably say Michael Jacobs, but you can't get tunnel vision on that because he may be a small cog in an entire machine. So you got to keep all options open. Yes, you want to keep an eye on Jacobs, but you also want to think about his associates, and you want to think about anyone who would have been at the club and maybe overheard what Jacobs was setting up. Those people are just as likely as he is because, yes, we have his cell phone data, but if we had their data, maybe it would align even better. My overall takeaway from this goes back to the saying, being a little fish in a big pond. Well, in this case, Michael and Christopher were little fish in the wrong pond. They had no business swimming in this water. The minute Michael decided to put out what he was in possession of, I believe he became the focus of a few different individuals who had malicious intent. And as far as how we figure out who they are, I believe there's more than one person that knows. I don't think this entire thing was pulled off by one person. So even if it is Michael Jacobs, he didn't do it alone. So how do we solve this case? Well, whenever something like this goes down, there's a hierarchy. There's someone who's going to get the most out of it, and there's lower level players who may have just made a phone call or been a lookout or whatever you might have. So the hope is that you eventually pinch one of those players. You bring them in and you let them know right out. You have little involvement, but a lot to lose. If you want to get off on whatever we're bringing you in for, we need to know about these murders. Because if you can make a deal with them because they didn't directly kill Christopher or Michael, then you can find out who the people are at the top and bring them down. But to do that, we need people to come forward because those witnesses may lead us to those low-level players that ultimately help solve this case. So just to recap, 35-year-old Michael Tardio and 31-year-old Christopher Monson were last seen on the night of September 1st, 2002, driving to a restaurant on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. They were in a Mercedes SUV heading to meet a man known only as Mr. Big to sell $1 million worth of stolen jewelry. Hours later, the SUV was found on fire in Studio City. Inside, Michael and Chris were both shot multiple times, and the jewelry was gone. Investigators later learned that Michael Jacobs, a convicted felon who had introduced Michael Tardio to Mr. Big, had been in contact with them multiple times that night, and cell phone records placed him near both the meeting location and the crime scene. So if you have any information about this case, please call Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477. My final words, as always, go out to Michael and Christopher's family. Yes, Michael made some mistakes, but he didn't deserve this. He should have paid for what he did, but he didn't have to pay for it with his life. And as far as Christopher's concerned, wrong place, wrong time, just being a good friend. I don't think he really had anything to do with the initial heist, and therefore he was just there supporting someone he cared about, and unfortunately, he was considered a liability to the actual people that we need to find. And I really do hope that the murderers are brought to justice sooner than later, not only for Michael and Christopher's family, but also for that community. Because as the city councilman said, this murderer is still on the loose and there may be multiple people involved. They need to answer for what they did. And if that day comes, whether it's an arrest or just new information, I'll be right here relaying it to you. Until then, everyone stay safe out there. I will see you in 2 weeks. Have a good night.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.